Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. If you would like to be on the program because you have something to say related to our general format, which is questions about the Bible or Christianity, or disagreements with the host on the same, feel free to give me a call and I will be glad to talk to you here on the air. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And if you give me a call right away, I think you can probably get on real quick because our lines are pretty clear right now. So it's 1-800-438-5090. One announcement about tonight for our friends listening on KKMC in the California Central Coast. That'd be if you're in Santa Cruz or Salinas or Monterey areas or thereabouts. We do have a weekly gathering in Salinas on Monday nights at 7 o'clock. It's a fellowship time, but it includes a study, which I teach, on the book of 1 Peter. But there's more than just the teaching. There's fellowship. There's worship and such. But the meeting is at 7 o'clock, and we invite you to join us if you are just looking for some place to have some fellowship in the midweek and would like to sit in on a Bible study and participate in the worship and so forth. That's every Monday night, and that would include tonight. If you don't know where it is because you've never been there before and would like to come tonight, let me give you a number to call, and you can call that number and get directions. Call 831, that's the area code, 831-442-8143. That's 442-8143 if you'd like to join us tonight at 7 o'clock. All right. Once again, the number to call to be on the air is different than that. That number is 1-800-438-5090. I just want to mention that I was in Las Vegas on the weekend, had a couple of different speaking appointments on Saturday. One was in a home group, a very wonderful group of people in the afternoon on Saturday. Beautiful group of people. We just had, three hours, I suppose, of Bible discussion, questions and answers and so forth. And then in the evening, evening, we had a debate. That is Tommy Bertoli and I did, and we debated on the subject of Israel. By the way, that was recorded, and they do have CDs of it. If you want to contact Tommy Bertoli, his church, I don't know his website, but I'm sure you could Google him and find out how to get those CDs. I would be posting them myself, and I might. We might post them on our website. I listened to part of the debate on CD and noticed that the microphones for myself and Tommy, we could tell during the talk that they were at very different volumes. Mine was quite loud. His was very quiet. And apparently the person recording the debate had the recording volume turned up so that it could pick up Tommy's microphone well, but that meant that my microphone really overmodulated, and so my talking is extremely distorted, very difficult to listen to, actually. You can kind of understand it, but it's got lots and lots of distortion. It's definitely not broadcast quality. I'm not even sure if it's quality to post at the Internet, but Tommy's talks came out clearly enough, and so we might post it, or I'm pretty sure that he'll be posting it at his website, which, again, I don't know his website off the top of my head, but his name is Tommy Bertoli, B-E-R-T-O-L-I, and if you Google him, put in Tommy Bertoli in Las Vegas, probably you'll probably find his website there. Anyway, I'll try to get a hold of his website so I can let you know. Maybe someone from Las Vegas can call and tell us Tommy's website, so you can go there if you'd like to. Anyway, we had a good time. Tommy and I had a good time, a fellowship together before the debate, and had some really good conversations with people afterwards as well. I enjoyed very much being there. We're going to talk to somebody from Las Vegas right now. We have lines open. Also, if you want to be on the program, the number is 1-800-438-5090. And while we don't really have any assigned topics on this program, and you can talk about any topic you like, it may be that some of you who were at the debate on the weekend would have liked to follow up with some questions but didn't get a chance, feel free to do that here today on the program. Our first caller is Gunther from Las Vegas. Hi, Gunther. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you. Hello, Steve. I'm not calling about the debate. I hope I don't disappoint you.
No, that's okay.
The reason I call, you had a gentleman on last week, and he's kind of a new Christian, and he asked you for advice about the Christian radio station, and if you should, if you can advise any or the, no, you know.
Oh, I think he was talking about television, Christian television.
Okay. Then I misunderstood, because the way I heard it, you know, you kind of said, no, don't listen to Christian radio station. So I was really disappointed. I said, how could he say that?
Yeah, how could I? I'm on the radio myself. He said that he had been watching Christian television, and he was getting confused. And I said, well, that's because you're watching Christian television. I don't recommend Christian television.
No, but Christian radio station, you recommend highly, no?
That is correct. My program is carried on four Christian radio stations now and on the internet.
I totally misunderstood them, because I've been listening to Christian radio stations for the last 30 years, and it changed my life. I'm a veteran, and you know, like Ralph Reese, Vietnam veteran, and alcohol, drugs, and I wasn't in drugs, but alcohol. And since the radio station, I mean, like Ralph Reese, I mean, Mikey Joseph and David Hacking, David Jeremiah. I mean, I'm walking on clouds when I listen to these guys.
Uh-huh.
And I just wanted to, but like you said, I misunderstood. That was the radio, TV station. Okay, not the radio, yeah. All right, I apologize then. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's quite all right.
Okay.
Okay, God bless you, Gunther.
God bless you guys, and keep up your good work.
Okay, thank you.
Here we come. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Yeah, Raul Reese is a friend of mine, has been from the 70s. He and I used to go on high school campuses and do evangelism together from time to time, back before he was pastoring the Calvary Chapel in Covina, California. Covina is where I grew up, though I didn't live there at the time that I knew him. Anyway, I haven't talked to him for years and years. David Jeremiah, David Hawking, some of those brothers I do not personally know, but of course I've heard them many times. And, you know, you do really get some pretty good quality teachers on radio. I wonder why television is so different. One reason might be that while it is expensive to be on radio or television, it's far more expensive to be on television. And therefore, the ministries that are on television either are rich or they must continually, emphasize the need for money. And I'm not saying that radio ministries don't emphasize their need for money. Some of them do. But, I think being on Christian television costs at least 10 times as much as being on radio. Maybe 100 times as much. I'm not sure. And therefore, what you have on Christian television is a very large percentage of programs that are of the word of faith, health and wealth persuasion. And they have no qualms about begging for money and even doing, in many cases, dishonest things to get money. I mean, they really need money to pay their television bills, but they seem to get more than enough, because the guys who run these ministries a lot of times are living like kings in palaces and so forth. And some of them have been exposed in the past for their not only their lavish lifestyles, but also their dishonest financial dealings. That is not to say that everybody on Christian TV is that way. I mean, you can see Billy Graham on TV sometimes, and he's a good guy, and he's not living a lavish lifestyle or anything like that. So I want to make it clear there are exceptions. But on balance, Christian TV is dominated very much by word of faith teaching, which is health and wealth gospel, which is not the gospel in the Bible. That's why I don't recommend Christian TV in general. I never have watched it, but I know who's on there. I've heard many of the speakers briefly when I was with somebody who was watching it. Christian radio, on the other hand, it's a mixed bag, too. I mean, obviously, if you agree with what I teach, and I'm not saying anyone needs to, but if you do, then you're going to disagree on a lot of things with some of the other men you mentioned. because there are different doctrinal opinions. But I, for example, all the men that you mentioned are dispensationalists, and I'm not. But I don't think that dispensationalism, even though I think it is wrong, I don't think it's as dangerous as the Word of Faith teaching is. The Word of Faith teaching is, as far as I'm concerned, is pure heresy. Dispensationalism, I think, is wrong, but I don't see it as being as harmful as some other kinds of heresies are. Maybe in some people's lives it may be. But the men you mentioned are, I believe, good men. And that's the difference. An awful lot of the Word of Faith teachers are charlatans, whereas a lot of dispensational teachers, though I disagree with their doctrine, are not charlatans. They're honest, good Christian men. And I know because I used to be one of them, and I was a good, honest Christian man then, too. But you don't have to be dispensational to be good, honest, or Christian. So you do get, you can't believe everything you hear on Christian radio. For example, if you believe what I say, you can't believe everything that some of these other guys say. Or if you believe what they say, you can't believe what I say. But the difference is you're not really going to find as much really bad heresy on Christian radio, I think, as you're likely to hear on Christian TV. Because the major Christian TV networks are all run by Word of Faith people. And they do sell time to some ministries that aren't Word of Faith. But there's an awfully heavy overbalance in that direction on that particular medium. So, Gunther, I appreciate your call. Sorry about the misunderstanding there. Our lines are open. This is Monday, first day of the week. I would expect a lot more calls coming through. We don't have anyone calling right now. So if you want to get on the air with me, the number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And a brother wrote to me last week, and let me see here. I'm afraid I didn't put his name down on it. Oh, he didn't sign his name. He just put his initial T. And he says, "Dear Steve, if God is omniscient, how are terms such as wrath applied when addressing his disposition? God knows all, so how could he, with foreknowledge, be wrathful or even disappointed, as though taken by surprise? Thank you for your time." Well, this is a good question, and it's been asked many times by thinking Christians. If God really does know all things in the future, then he knows what's going to happen before anything happens, and therefore it would seem impossible for him to be surprised by anything. And equally difficult for him to be really upset when things happen, since he's known from eternity that they were going to, or for him to be disappointed or anything like that, because, I mean, how could he experience any emotion about things that happen when nothing is new to him? He's known forever that these things were going to happen, so how could he experience any kind of emotion about them at the moment of their transpiring? Well, I don't know. There's different ways that people have tried to solve that problem. It is a philosophical difficulty, I could see. Some would say, some go to the one end of the spectrum and some to the other. At one end of the spectrum, you have the people who are the open theology people who say, well, God actually doesn't know all the future. He knows all future things that he intends himself to do. But he doesn't know all future things that people will do, because if he did, that would make their actions determined before they happened, and there'd be no free will. So they say, well, obviously the free will choices of people, choices that have not yet been made historically and might go any direction for all anyone could anticipate, because they have not been determined yet, cannot be known before they happen. And so they would say God doesn't know those things. He knows everything else. He knows everything there is to know. But that future choices by free will agents is not something that can be known, because it's just not knowable. That's what one category would say. Then you go to the other extreme and you find the strict Augustinian Calvinists. And they would say, well, God not only knows, but has determined everything that's going to happen. And you say, well, if he's determined it all, if he has decreed that it all will happen infallibly and sovereignly, how could he be upset that what happens, is what he decreed? How could that upset him? And many Calvinists, at least, believe a doctrine called the impassibility of God. And impassibility means God feels no emotion. God is without passions. He has no passions. He has no emotions. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute, when I read the Bible, I certainly see God having passions and emotions. I see even Jesus weeping and rejoicing and having anger. And I mean, those are emotions. And in the Old Testament, you continually read of God having emotions and all, and good, bad, and I mean, I should say happy and sad and angry and lots of things like that. But the Calvinists would say, well, yeah, when you read about those emotions in Jesus, it's probably just his human nature experiencing emotion. But God in the Old Testament, when it speaks of him being, you know, rejoicing or sad, it's using anthropomorphic language, they would say. Now, anthropomorphic means human-like. Some, you know, that God is being described in a human-like way, but he's not really human, and therefore you're not supposed to take those things absolutely literally. Similar when the Bible speaks about God's hand or his eye or his mouth as if he has physical parts. Well, I mean, most Christians agree that God doesn't have physical parts. He's a spirit. And therefore, they say all references to his hands and his mouth and his eyes are simply anthropomorphic. They're a figure of speech speaking about God as if he were a man. And Calvinists would often say that when you read of God's emotions, these two are anthropomorphic devices. So the problem is solved different ways by people at different ends of the spectrum. Though on one hand, some say God does feel emotions and surprise even. And disappointment, because he doesn't know what's going to happen in many cases until people have made their choices. At the other end, it says, well, God does know and has ordained it all, and therefore all this talk about his emotions about it is simply anthropomorphic. He doesn't really have such emotions. Now, I'm actually in the middle of those two, and that's why the people at the Calvinist end would call me semi-Pelagian, because I'm, you know, the other edge, the openness theology, is kind of like Pelagianism. And I'm an Arminian. That is the historic position of the church. All the church fathers apparently were Arminian, as near as we can tell from their writings, until about the time of Augustine in 400 AD. So I'm holding the view that basically all the Christians held until Augustine. And that view is that God does indeed know the future, which would seem like he couldn't be disappointed. It would seem like he couldn't be surprised. He couldn't feel emotions, but that's not necessarily true, because you can know what's coming up and still be angry or happy when it happens. You can. I can know with almost absolute certainty that my children are going to have a birthday or that Christmas is coming. And I don't know everything about it, but I have, unless the world comes to an end between now and then, I can be quite sure that those things are happening. But my happiness about it or my enjoyment of it does not occur until those things actually do transpire. It's, and I've often used this illustration, our regular listeners have heard it before, but I think of this when I'm thinking about this very issue. How can God know what's going to happen and then still feel genuine emotions about it when it does? I have watched many movies, that is films, that move me, sometimes into great sorrow, sometimes to tears. Some of them leave me feeling angry because, you know, there's an unresolved injustice. Some of them, of course, make you feel good. There are emotions you feel watching movies. And you know what? If I watch the same movie 6 months later or a year later, I'll feel those same emotions again, even though I know before I watch the movie all the things I'm going to see. I know what's going to happen. If I have very good memory, I can remember virtually every line, every choice the character is going to make, every disaster that's going to happen. But it's as I watch them take place, as they actually take place on the stage before me, that's when I experience genuine emotions about it. My having known beforehand, because I've seen the movie before, does not prevent me from having real emotions when I see those things portrayed graphically before me in real time. Now, some people think God doesn't have real time, that God doesn't live in time. He lives outside of time. The Bible doesn't tell us that. That's only a philosophical theory that many Christians have held for centuries. But in my opinion, he does seem to experience things in real time. He certainly talks about things always as if he does. But he also knows the future. How? I don't know. How does he feel emotions? I don't know. But I can think of analogies in my own life. I think, well, if I can, then so can he. I mean, if I can know something is going to happen and then have an emotion about it when it does, then I would think God could do the same thing. Why not? He's not more limited or more, what should we say, one-dimensional than I am. He's a nuanced person like the rest of us, only different. Let's talk to Eric from Las Vegas, Nevada next. Hi, Eric. Welcome to The Narrow Path, and thanks for calling.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good to hear you.
Yeah, I definitely stopped watching Christian television.
Yeah.
Now, I had a question. I've been trying to talk to my friends, which most of them aren't Christians. And, when I try to convert them, or at least, talk to them about Jesus, and God, they tell me, because you guys were talking last week about how God somewhat, lets pain happen.
Yeah.
Kind of lets things happen to you. And they tell me, so when a 3-year-old child gets raped and killed by a crazy guy, gets raped and murdered, you're telling me that God lets it happen and things like that. And I'm not sure. I mean, I know I'm a beginner, but I'm not sure how to answer that.
Yeah. Well, they always use that example of a child being raped and murdered, which is a terrible, a horrible injustice. But really, the whole question hinges on how does God actually stand by and permit any injustice?
Right.
The rape and murder of a child is heinous to us because we have such sympathy for the innocence of the child. But really, many adults who are not anywhere near as innocent as a child suffer genuine injustice that they didn't deserve every day. And so the real question is not, why does God allow great tragedies to occur? The real question is, why does God allow bad things to happen at all? Why hasn't he made a world where everything just goes well? No one victimizes anyone else at any level. That's really the question. The use of the child illustration is simply to underscore emotionally how difficult this problem can be. But it's a problem every day when we see anything happen that shouldn't happen, and which contradicts what God says ought to be happening. And the way I have understood it, and actually I've written extensively about this on our Bible Forum not long ago, I've written quite a lot on this very, very, very question. I consider it to be similar to something I went through a couple years ago. My son broke his arm in a skateboarding accident. We'd never gone to a hospital with any of our children before, but we went to the hospital. And by the time we got there, we sat in the emergency room for a long time, and the bone had, begun to, I guess, set up or something. I don't know much about it, but when we finally got to see the doctor many hours later, he said he was going to have to re-break the bone or else the arm was going to grow back wrong. Now, re-breaking the bone is extremely painful, and he was asking my permission to break my son's bone and subject my son to excruciating pain. And I gave that permission. I allowed my son to experience that pain. Why? Because I had to weigh two things in balances. One was my desire that my son would never experience pain. And, of course, every parent has that desire. God has that desire, too. God would desire that none of us would ever have to suffer because he's got a father's heart toward his children. And fathers don't want their children to suffer and would do anything they could to prevent their children from suffering unless that suffering was necessary for some good purpose. In this case, I knew that if I did not let the doctor re-break his arm, he's going to live the rest of his life with a crooked arm. And I thought, well, a few moments of pain or maybe even a few days of pain is worth more than a lifetime of regrets. Now, here's where I see the analogy. I believe that while we do not always appreciate what God is doing, everything he does is a loving act intended to remedy something about our crookedness. We are born crooked, and we make ourselves more crooked as we live our lives and make bad choices and develop evil habits, and sin becomes dominant in our lives and ingrained. And that's a great sickness that has to be surgically removed. It can't be removed without pain any more than that arm could have been fixed without pain. Why? Well, for various reasons. I mean, people say, why couldn't God do it without pain? Well, that would get us into a much deeper discussion. But the fact is that we are broken, and we are not mended right. And we try to mend ourselves with all kinds of choices and remedies, and we just end up going crookeder. And so sometimes God has to intervene because he loves us in ways that he would in no way prefer for us to have to go through if we weren't broken. Now, I believe the reason we're broken is because of the choices we've made. I don't think God ever chose that you would sin or that I would sin. I think I made those choices for myself, and you made those choices for yourself. And God finds it so and intends to heal us, intends to fix us. And so he subjects us to spiritual surgery. Now we say, how is the rape of a child spiritual surgery? Well, in that case, I really can't say. I don't know what God intends to accomplish through such a thing. I have found over the years, I've heard many, many stories of terrible tragedies that have occurred, which ended up working out very much for the good of many concerned parties. Now, the death of an innocent child, including pain and suffering preceding death, is something we can never really fully quantify how the value of that or what particular benefits could possibly be worth that kind of horrible thing. But then we would not be good at quantifying anything along those lines. I mean, any of the sufferings we go through, whether they're that extreme or less extreme, it'd be like a 3-year-old child trying to understand why his father's letting the doctor break his arm. You know, Dad, I already hurt myself. How come you're letting this man hurt me? You're standing there giving him permission. Well, the 3-year-old can't understand, and the father can't even explain it to him to his satisfaction. The 3-year-old just has to trust that his daddy loves him, and his daddy will do everything he can to prevent him suffering. And if his dad allows him to suffer when it's in his father's power to prevent it, that allowing of it has got to be because there's some good reason that the child may not ever fully understand, or probably will at some time, but doesn't at the time. But the father understands. And you know, a non-Christian is never going to appreciate that argument, because the non-Christian has not begun to fear God. And the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, the Bible says. This I believe to be true, and I can see it to be true in non-Christians, because they don't have God in their thoughts. They don't have the fear of God governing them. They see themselves in the position to evaluate and judge and maybe even condemn God. Well, anyone who's thinking like that is, strictly speaking, a fool. That's what the Bible says. They haven't begun to have wisdom or knowledge. They may think themselves very wise, but you can go to your college and you can go to your school. But if you ain't got Jesus, you're just an educated fool, an old black spiritual said. And that's really the truth. The fool has said in his heart there's no God. And the man who, you know, doesn't fear God hasn't begun to have wisdom. I would not hope that I would gain the approval of an unbeliever with that argument I just gave, because he does not trust that God is a loving father. And he doesn't he doesn't even think that God is good. He's not even sure there is a God. So, in other words, that argument won't win them. Before anyone can solve the great mysteries of God's providence, including his permission of suffering, they're going to have to learn the ABCs of who God is, that there is a God, and that he's God and we're not. And that's pretty much the lesson of the book of Job, isn't it? I mean, if you read the book of Job, Job suffered tremendous injustices. He was robbed. His children were killed in what seemed like a natural disaster. He was suffering boils. He deserved none of this, and he didn't understand, and he never came to understand. As far as we know, Job never understood why those things happened to him. And he puzzled over it. He questioned it. He got angry about it, but he never figured out what it was. God showed up and began to talk to Job. In fact, he talked to him for about 6 chapters long, and one thing that God did do is say, I'm God and you're not. One thing God didn't do is explain to Job why Job had to go through these things. But Job got the message. I get it. God is God. I'm not God. I'm a little speck of dust. But for some reason, God cares about me. And God, therefore, in his wisdom and his goodness, will, through his providence, do in my life what he sees best. And it's not mine necessarily to demand an explanation from God. The time will come where if I see him, and I will, that I will perhaps understand far better than I can understand now. But see, people who don't love God, don't believe in God, don't fear God, those answers, that just sounds foolishness to them. And so here I've said they're foolish because they don't fear God, and they would think I'm foolish because I do, and because I do believe in God. So here's the question. Is there a God to be feared, or is there not? If there is, then they're the fool and I'm wise. If there's not, then I'm the fool and they're wise. And that's basically where we got to start. If they don't believe there's a God, you can't get any further with them.
Yeah, well, I also, because there are some preachers that say that God doesn't permit anything and all he wants is good, and that it's the devil who...
That's those guys on TV, isn't it? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do this. I accidentally hit a hold button for you. Continue.
There's some preachers that say that God doesn't, you know...
Yeah, those are the Word of Faith teachers. Those are the guys I was mentioning on Christian TV. They're teaching people what they want to hear. They're basically saying, if you do what God wants you to do, and you keep God happy with your faith and your positive confessions and your giving, of course, to their ministry, then only good things will happen to you. You won't be sick. You won't be poor. Nothing bad will happen because God will be on your side then, and he never wants anything bad to happen to you. It's the devil who does. And so you need to learn how to make the right positive confessions, learn how to give the right amount of money to the ministry that we have on TV, and then the devil can't get to you because God's principles of faith, the law of faith, will work on your behalf and protect you against all these things. That works perhaps for shallow people who don't know what the Bible says, and frankly, anyone who watches those TV shows and likes them is a shallow person by definition. Anyone who sends money to them is, well, I don't have a word to express the disrespect I have for people who would send money to such charlatans. I think people ought to read the Bible. And if they did, they'll find that God is continually afflicting even good people. The psalmist said, it is good for me that I was afflicted, that I might keep your law. He even said, O Lord, I know that your judgments are just and that in faithfulness you have afflicted me. That is, God has afflicted me. And I'm not blaming God. I'm glorifying God by saying, God, you did this because you're faithful. In your faithfulness you afflicted me. I have to say I either deserved it or needed it. And God knew which, and the Bible continually said, God gave Paul a thorn in the flesh. He touched Jacob's thigh and crippled the man. When he was talking to Moses at the burning bush, and Moses said, "Well, I don't speak well. I'm slow of speech. I stutter. Therefore, don't send me, but you're going to have to send somebody else to confront Pharaoh." Because I'm just not good at talking. Well, God said this, who made a man's mouth or his the seeing or these kinds of things? Here's the verse. It's Exodus 4, verse 11. God said, who has made man's mouth? Who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, or the blind? Have not I, the Lord? And God is... Basically, he certainly is the one who allowed the devil to come and hurt Job. It wasn't Job that allowed it. Job didn't do anything wrong, and God said so. God said that Job was blameless and feared God and eschewed evil. See, the Word of Faith teachers have to say, well, Job brought it on himself, and God himself couldn't protect Job because Job was not making faith statements. Well, there's certainly, first of all, nowhere in the book of Job or elsewhere in Scripture does it ever say such a thing about Job. And secondly, God said the opposite about Job. God told Satan, after God had allowed the first wave of trials to come on Satan, and Satan came back and wanted to do worse things, God said, well, you've moved me to afflict him without cause. In other words, God is saying that all these things that happened to Job, they happened without God having a cause against him. It wasn't that Job didn't have faith. That would have been a cause of his sufferings. There was no cause found in Job for his sufferings. But God had a purpose which he never explained. We can guess at it, and we can probably get some lessons from it, but we certainly can. But we can't fully explain why God allowed Job to go through those things. But the lesson of Job is God does, in fact, allow the devil to do that to godly people. And he has good reasons for it. He just doesn't tell us all the time what they are.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't mean to take up all your time, but I had one more question. Is that okay?
Okay. My lines are full, but we're on this topic. If it's a related question.
Okay. Well, you know what? It's okay. I'll let you get to them. You thank you, and you help me, and God bless you.
Well, Eric, God bless you, and feel free to call with your other questions tomorrow.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. No problem. Have a good one.
Okay. Bye now, you too. Okay, our next call is from Naomi in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Naomi. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi there, Steve. I was reading in my Bible this morning and had a question that I've never really looked into out of 1 Corinthians 15:29,
mm-hmm.
where it says, now
baptized for the dead?
Yes, and I don't know the historical or the biblical background of that, and just was wondering if you had some insight to share.
The truth is, nobody does. Teachers have often speculated. There have been, now this is no exaggeration, this is sober calculation. There have been 40 different suggested meanings of this verse by commentators, okay? That's how different people have viewed it. I have my own leanings as to how I think Paul meant it, but there's a different leaning that most commentators would have. The verse, for those who don't know it, says, Paul says, otherwise, what will they do who are baptized for the dead? If the dead do not rise at all, why then are they baptized for the dead? So it sounds like Paul is talking about, well, there are people being baptized for the dead. Why would they do that if there's no resurrection? The common answer you'll get from most people that you'd ask who are Christian teachers is this, that there were people, perhaps in some of the mystery cults, that were baptizing dead living people by proxy for dead friends or relatives, sort of like what the Mormons do.
Yeah.
You know, the Mormons practice this. And what most Christian teachers say is in Paul's day, he knew of groups that did that, just like the Mormons. But that Paul is not saying that they're doing the right thing, or, Paul's not teaching that it should be done. In fact, Paul makes a distinction between him and his readers, on the one hand, and these people who do this, because in the next verse he says, and why do we stand in jeopardy every hour? So in verse 29 he says, what will they who are baptized for the dead do if there's no resurrection? But then he says, and why do we stand in jeopardy every hour? So the teachers have said this, we means us Christians. They means somebody else who aren't Christians, some other group of people, and they baptize for the dead. And why would they do that if there's no resurrection from the dead?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is the common answer you'll get, namely that there were people practicing baptism for the dead, just as the Mormons do now, but that Paul's giving no endorsement to the practice. Well, maybe so. But it seems strange to me. This answer has never been very satisfying to me because, although I've heard it since I was young, since I was a teenager, this is the answer I've heard. It didn't make a lot of sense because Paul is giving this statement in the midst of an argument where he's trying to argue for the doctrine of the resurrection of the dead.
Is this the only time he made in the Bible that statement is made about baptism for the dead?
Yes, this is the only place in the Bible that mentions the term baptized for the dead.
Okay.
So it's all we have to go on.
All
and
right.
It appears, and in this chapter, Paul is arguing with people who doubt the baptism of the dead. They are people in the church, however. They are some of the Christians who, because of their Greek philosophy, have doubted that the dead rise. And he's arguing for that doctrine, saying basically, if you don't believe that doctrine, you can't believe the gospel at all, because if the dead don't rise, then even Jesus didn't rise, because he was dead. And therefore, if you acknowledge that Jesus rose from the dead, you must acknowledge that resurrection from the dead is a possible phenomenon. So what Paul says is anyone who denies the resurrection of the dead in principle is denying that Jesus rose from the dead and is denying the gospel and can't be saved with that belief.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the course of making an extensive argument for the doctrine of the resurrection, he makes this comment. If there's no resurrection of the dead, what shall they do who are baptized for the dead if the dead don't rise at all? Why are they baptized for the dead? Now, if Paul is referring to the practices of somebody that he does not agree with, that'd be a very strange argument to make. In other words, here's some people practicing something that I don't agree with, but I'll use it as an argument for the resurrection of the dead anyway. You know, well, why would he use a cultic practice as an argument for an orthodox doctrine? It doesn't seem likely that he would. He could possibly. It just would be a strange thing to do. I think there's a better answer, perhaps. And as I said, 40 different answers have been given by different commentators. And the reason is no one really knows if there were cults baptizing people by proxy like the Mormons do back then. That's an assumption. When the teachers say that that was happening, that's an assumption they're making from the verse itself. They don't have extra biblical information about it. They're just assuming that since Paul said it, and since that's what they think he means, that itself documents that some people were practicing proxy baptism. But the question is Paul talking about the same practice that the Mormons practice? Is he even talking about proxy baptism? I think maybe not. I think he could very well be talking about Christian baptism. Now, why? Because we Christians are baptized into Christ. The word for, baptized for the dead, is a very weak Greek preposition that just means with reference to.
Mm-hmm.
And can we translate, why are they baptized with reference to the dead if the dead don't rise? Now, what he's already earlier in the chapter said, if the dead don't rise, then Jesus didn't rise.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if we don't acknowledge that the dead can rise and will rise, then we can't acknowledge that Jesus rose, and therefore, what is he? He's dead. Why would people be baptized with reference to a dead man, which is what Jesus is if the dead don't rise at all? So that's what Paul says. What will they do who are baptized with reference to the dead, meaning the dead Jesus who's not alive, on this condition, if the dead don't rise at all? If the dead don't rise at all, then Jesus is dead. Why would we be baptized with reference to Jesus, who is dead if the dead don't rise? So I think what he would be saying then, and this is only one of many possible meanings, but it makes sense to me, it would make a good argument for his case, that the very fact that we're baptized into the death and resurrection of Christ, and that's what he says we are baptized into in Romans 6:6 and other verses, not Romans 6:6, Romans 6:1-5 more like, also Colossians 2:11-12. He says that we are buried with Christ in baptism, and when we come through baptism, we're also baptized into his resurrection. And why would we do that if he's dead? If Jesus hasn't resurrected, it makes no sense at all to be baptized into him, because the baptism itself is a picture of burial and resurrection. Why would we do that if the person we're celebrating is a dead man and has not resurrected himself? And I think that is Paul's point. But as I said, it may be something else. But one thing that we cannot prove is what is so often asserted, namely that there were people practicing a Mormon-like practice of proxy baptism, and that Paul is alluding to it without endorsing it. Whatever he alludes to, he sounds like he's endorsing, because he's using it as an argument for a Christian doctrine, their practice.
I agree. I think in the spirit of having, you know, reading that whole chapter, and I have a Bible college background and graduate school, it just was something I guess I never thought about much.
Yeah.
And I was reading the whole chapter and thinking he's arguing for the resurrection and using this as an illustration, you know, to back up his argument. So
right.
Is there something culturally or something that maybe the Essenes did or some Jewish sect that I, you know, don't know about? But I love your perspective on in reference to the dead, or I even think of we're all dead before we are alive in Christ, and
yeah.
Baptism is a symbolism of our death and resurrection.
That's true.
So thank you so much. That's a new perspective, and I love to meditate on that. Thank you so much, Steve.
Okay, Naomi. Thank you for your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay, Dane from Somerset, Pennsylvania. Long time no hear, brother. Good to hear from you.
Hey, thanks. Good to talk to you again, Steve. I've got a question I'm going to ask, and then I'm just going to get off the line if I can. Romans 8:17, if you can help me understand that. Paul said that we are heirs of Christ if, it sounds conditional, if we suffer with him. And so I'm trying to understand what the suffering that he's referring to. I mean, it's pretty clear, I think, that suffering for righteousness' sake is something that might be included. And I know Peter in 1 Peter, I think, 4 talks about not suffering as a murderer and evildoer and things like that. So that kind of suffering would probably be ruled out. But are there other types of suffering? In other words, is that what Paul has in mind? And I guess my question also is, you know, what if we suffer because someone else makes a bad, you know, someone makes a bad choice, like a drunk driver hits us, or we suffer because we've contracted an illness, you know, no choice of ours, it just befalls
yeah.
us. Is that the type of suffering he's referring to? You know, what does he mean by if we suffer with him?
Okay. Yeah, I'll be glad to address that.
Great.
Thank you.
All right. Appreciate that.
Thanks, Dane. God bless you.
See you now. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Well, first of all, there's different kinds of suffering, of course. One is specifically suffering because you're a Christian, or perhaps just because you're doing the right thing. Even if people don't, they may not care whether you're a Christian or not, but they object to the fact that you're a righteous person because they're doing something unrighteous, and they object to your stand that you're taking. Jesus actually, in the Sermon on the Mount, kind of made suffering for righteousness' sake interchangeable with suffering for Jesus' sake. In Matthew 5:10, he said, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And the next verse, he says, "Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my name's sake," or "for my sake." So in two successive verses, he's talking about the same experience. One, he refers to suffering for my sake. The other is suffering for righteousness' sake. A Christian, of course, if they're really following Christ, will have to take a righteous stand, even when it's unpopular and even when they may suffer for it. And therefore, sometimes people who don't care one way or another about Jesus, or don't even know anything about Jesus, it may be, may hate you because you're doing the right thing in a situation where they want only everyone to do the wrong thing with them. But it's the same thing. And I think that Christians don't always get the chance to be persecuted specifically for their Christian testimony. Living in America, for example, provides much less opportunity to go to jail or become a martyr just because you are following Jesus Christ than you would find in, say, the Roman Empire in Paul's day, especially during Nero's time, or in some countries today. So it's not your fault you're born in America. It's not your fault if you suffer less than others. And I don't think that Paul is saying the more you suffer, the more brownie points you'll get necessarily. What I think he's saying is this. We do suffer. I think he took it for granted that his readers do suffer for Christ. And because they did live in the Roman Empire, they were in Rome, they probably were suffering in ways that we don't generally suffer here in America. They were probably suffering forms of persecution that we have never experienced. On the other hand, even if they were or were not, all Christians suffer some things. I mean, even self-imposed suffering for Christ's sake. Whereas a non-Christian would simply go out and indulge every lust, a Christian may, deprive himself. That's a mild form of suffering. Deprive himself of cravings that he has, fleshly cravings, because for Christ's sake he doesn't allow himself that liberty or that, that luxury. Christians do make sacrifices, even if they're small sacrifices, for Christ's sake. Some make great sacrifices. But I think what Paul is suggesting is, I don't think he's trying to say, now we need to go out and find a way to suffer so that we can reign with Christ, because you have to suffer, and that's a special category of Christian experience so that you can reign with him. I think what he's saying is, the Christian life is itself a sort of suffering for Christ's sake, a suffering with him. Not all Christians suffer equally, but Paul said to Timothy, all who would live Christ, righteous in Christ Jesus, godly in Christ Jesus, will suffer persecution. It may be a small kind of persecution. You may never feel rocks thrown into your head like Stephen did, or never be nailed to a cross, or hang in a dungeon somewhere for Christ, or be tortured or killed. But on the other hand, anyone who takes a stand for Christ is going to have some people who will give them a wide berth, who will steer clear of them, who will speak evil of them because of their convictions. Even if that Christian never even knows that that's happening, the fact that he is enduring, whether he's fully aware of it or not, ostracism and perhaps the loss of certain privileges that would come with, if everyone liked them better, there is a suffering going on. We all do suffer. And by the way, so do non-Christians. The difference is, non-Christians suffer just because they live in a world that involves injustice and suffering. Christians suffer for those reasons too, but Christians also have the additional suffering that comes from saying, I'm going to live for Christ, which is like swimming upstream against a stiff tide, because the world is pushing me one way, and I'm going to fight it. I'm going to fight it. I'm not going to take the easy route. And taking the hard route, the narrow road is the hard road, Jesus said, that leads to life. That is a form of suffering. And you and I might say, well, I don't recall ever suffering much for Jesus, certainly not when I read about those great martyrs of the past. But Paul's not necessarily saying here that you have to be martyred or even thrown in jail for Christ, though some of his readers probably were, but just that the Christian life itself involves sacrifices and sufferings that you wouldn't make if you weren't following Christ. And that's just the path you choose. If you want to reign with him, you choose the path that involves suffering of various kinds. Now, as far as suffering, from accidents or from sickness, that kind of suffering is not specifically for Christ's sake, although the way you go through that suffering may be for Christ's sake. You know, if things happen that are beyond your control or accidental or merely, you know, sickness or whatever, your response to that, the way you respond to God and the way you testify to God in the midst of your suffering may indeed turn that into something that has great benefit for Christ's sake. Whereas if you complain and grumble and lose faith and so forth, then, of course, that same suffering is not turned into glory for you. So all suffering, if handled properly, can be turned into something godly. And that's what Christianity involves universally in varying degrees. We only have a couple minutes left, but Nick from Buffalo, New York, you got the last word. Welcome.
Hey, thank you. Hey, I was just wondering, you seem to look at the New Jerusalem, the heavenly city Jerusalem. Unless I caught you wrong, you seem to look at it from less of a preterist perspective and more futurist. I could have been wrong interpreting you, but I look at it as more, you know, from a preterist position. Could you flesh that out, elaborate
sure.
on that concerning the
sure.
heavenly city Jerusalem?
Yeah, well, first of all, the New Jerusalem, or the heavenly Jerusalem, is the church, right? I mean, in Galatians 4, Paul says that the Jerusalem above is the mother of us all. And in Hebrews chapter 12, the writer of Hebrews says, we have come to the heavenly Jerusalem, which he identifies as the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are written in heaven. Well, the church of the firstborn is the church, and that's the spiritual Jerusalem. In Revelation, however, we see that Jerusalem coming down from heaven to earth, having the glory of God, John says. Now, having the glory of God is something that I think is a future state of the church. The church exists now, but as it says in 1 John, John also wrote Revelation, I believe, in 1 John chapter 3, he says, beloved, now we are the children of God, but does not yet appear what we shall be. But we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And being like him is the glory of God. I believe that when Jesus comes back, the church will be glorified in a manner that it has not yet been. And in Revelation 21 and 22, John sees the New Jerusalem coming down, having the glory of God. That makes it the eschatological New Jerusalem, it seems to me. It's still the church. It's the church. There's only one church. It started with Jesus and has continued ever since. In fact, we might even argue it started in the Old Testament. But the point is, the church of which you and I belong, which is the body of Christ, will someday be glorified. And I think that in Revelation 21 and 22, it is talking about that time when the New Jerusalem has the glory of God. In the meantime, we are the New Jerusalem, but we have not yet really been glorified. And that's how I would understand that.
Makes sense. Cool. Thank you.
Okay, Nick, God bless you. Sorry we can't talk longer, but we got to cover it briefly.
It's okay.
All right. We'll talk again.
Bye.
Bye now. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast, and my name is Steve Gregg. If you want to go to our website, you'll find a lot of free resources there. You'll never find anything for sale in this ministry either. We don't sell things by radio, or by mail, or by website. We just don't have anything for sale. But we've got a lot of stuff for free. Hundreds of MP3s you can download, and other stuff too at the website. It's thenarrowpath.com. Now, even though we don't sell stuff, we still do have expenses. And if you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. I'll give you that address again. It's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Also, I want you to remember that we have, if you're in the Salinas area, we have a meeting in Salinas tonight, 7 o'clock. Information at the website. So many things at the website. Check it out. It's thenarrowpath.com. Thank you for joining us. I hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and we'll continue our discussion. Till then, this is Steve Gregg. May God bless you.